Are we all set?
Well, I got a question for you.
Yes.
Good afternoon. I'm opening the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, Subcommittee on Public Safety. Today is March 27, 2017. Public hearing on Senate Bill 5515, District Attorney and their deputies. So I know I see Kevin there, and who's joining you? Okay, and Rick Wiesenberg is joining Kevin.
And Michelle.
Oh, Michelle's joining us. Where's Tim? Is Tim? No, he's not here.
Tim is in McCall, Idaho on spring break. So you guys timed our budget just perfectly for Tim as far as he's concerned.
Okay. You've missed this, haven't you, Kevin?
It's good to be back, Senator.
Okay.
But I'm going to let our president start.
Coach Winter, I'm sorry?
I think I'll first have our LFO staff, Mr. Borden, walk us through this.
Excuse me, Senator.
And then we'll hear from you.
Good afternoon, Madam Co-Chair and members of the subcommittee. LFO doesn't have much to add. Our analysis is out on the iDrive, as well as the district attorney's presentation, the CFO's presentation. Due to my oversight, we had an email issue. It will be posted later this evening. So, Madam Co-Chair, that's about
okay.
It, if you will.
Good. Now, Mr. Wiesenberg.
Thank you, Senator. Co-Chair Winters, Co-Chair Stark, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to present the district attorney's proposed budget. My name is Rick Wiesenberg. I'm the district attorney in Douglas County and the current president of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. Before we begin, I want to thank you personally and on behalf of the other 36. I want to thank you for already filling our budget hole, our existing budget hole that we had for the 2015-2017 biennium. If you're not already aware, you will learn that in a few moments that any shortfall in our budget results in direct salary reductions for the Oregon's 36 elected district attorneys. Also, as I move forward through the presentation,
for the record, you might want to explain, because not all counties are equal.
Yes, ma'am. Do you want to talk about the two-tier system, or
go ahead and do it, or I can do it?
Go ahead.
Okay. We do have, I think, at least one member that's new to the committee. So it might be well.
A couple members that are new. I don't know. Yeah. I'm new to the committee, too, because I haven't been with the DA's for a long time. For the record, Kevin Neely. I'm the lobbyist for the Oregon District Attorneys Association. Chair Winters, Co-Chair Stark, thank you guys so much for the question. We do have in Oregon two tiers, basically a large county and a small county tier. Going back 10 years ago, we actually had three tiers and had part-time district attorneys. So about 10 years ago, the legislature had the good sense to get rid of the idea of a part-time district attorney, because most of them had a separate legal practice. And by now, we have just two separate tiers, a large county tier. They make a slightly higher salary than the small counties. And I think our President Wiesenberg will talk a little bit as we move through the presentation about about the relative sizes of the counties that we have out there and the jurisdictions and kind of how that breaks down. So, again, thank you, Senator. We do have two tiers of salary. Pretty straightforward stuff.
Thank you.
And
Thank you, Co-Chair Winters. As far as determining large and small, what's the cutoff?
100,000, a population of 100,000.
For the county?
Correct.
Thank you.
So it's useful, of course, to start with our mission statement. It's there for you on the screen in the materials. But as you can see, it's quite simple and straightforward. And over time, we've updated it expressly to highlight the importance of supporting survivors of crime and to pursue justice with honor and respect for all Oregonians, regardless of their ethnicity, their income level, their age, or frankly, any other demographic. Oregon's district attorneys are among a handful of executive branch officers that are expressly authorized by the Oregon Constitution. The state's 36 independently elected DAs prosecute virtually all crime in Oregon. The size of individual offices varies widely. There are offices that have a single employee, the district attorney, to offices that have over 100 prosecutors and hundreds of additional support staff. Most jurisdictions receive cases from a wide variety of law enforcement agencies within their county, and as a result, the district attorney plays a critical role in ensuring that there is a standard prosecution that applies throughout their county. And I think that, relatively speaking, I believe our budget is quite simple. It is exclusively limited to the salaries and benefits for the 36 elected DAs, as well as the required agency administrative fees. This slide offers a specific breakdown of the governor's recommended budget. Again, it makes clear that the compensation and service changes are the only two items that are paid for by the state. The governor's recommended budget recommends an appropriation of approximately $12.5 million. That's under five. Outside of a possible COLA, it contemplates no salary increases for the district attorneys. So essentially, it's a current service level. Like Oregon's judges, for many years, the salaries of elected district attorneys were well below the national average. Progress has been made on that front. However, in order to retain high-quality district attorneys and to be sure that the position is compensated in line with other similarly situated county administrators, over two-thirds of the counties offer some level of additional compensation to their local district attorney.
How many of the counties actually do provide additional compensation?
Co-Chair Winters, Co-Chair Stark, members of the committee, I'll have to get back to you on that exact number. I know we have the list, and I'll be happy to provide the list. I don't know if Art maybe, yeah. I apologize. I probably should have had that in hand, but I'll get back to you on that one.
Thank you.
There is not, however, a cent of the budget that is allocated for deputy district attorneys and other services provided by the county DAs. For years, we have come before this subcommittee and brought up the historical references to Senate Bill 1, which required deputy supplements as it shifted the responsibility for prosecution to the county's budgets and the court's cost, the state's budget. We've distributed reports that recommended enhanced state participation in the prosecution function. At this point, and with the budget constraints that this legislature faces, our members have abandoned any expectation of restoration of past performance of past programs or enhancement based on prior reports. We did not ask for any such action from the governor, and we are not seeking it from this subcommittee. I can tell you that as a district attorney from Southern Oregon, the counties in Southern Oregon are in dire shape. They have traditionally and historically relied on timber revenue, and when timber revenue fell off, they were relying on secure rural schools, SRS funding. That funding is now stopped as well, and so we are barreling toward a crisis from the standpoint of counties being able to provide law enforcement services and prosecution services. It bears mentioning that this budget has absolutely no funding for any administration of the agency itself, the ODAA. And unlike other small agencies, we do not receive funding for DAS assistance related to the budget development or other routine administrative work. Rather, that work is done through the Department of Justice. As far as we know, that they receive no additional funds for their work either. Additionally, DOJ has for decades provided a single position in their criminal justice division that helps support the Oregon District Attorneys Association, which is, of course, our professional membership association. We are grateful for the DOJ assistance and for the Attorney General.
Excuse me, but isn't that how all the other professional associations, it's from their membership?
Senator Winters.
You can get back to me on offline on this, because I think we've had this discussion before.
I'm happy to chat with you online, but very offline. But briefly, I think what is unique about our situation is our budget development for the actual agency is prepared not by a state employee, but instead by private contractors like me that are principally paid for out of the allocations that are made by the individual district attorney's offices through their county dollars. And I think that's what really sets our organization apart from a lot of other state agencies.
But other state agencies aren't elected officials either.
True.
Okay. Thank you, Senator.
I'm listening.
The other issue for us is that there is likewise no appropriation for data or IT services or ongoing training, and so that is handled either through at the county level or through the ODAA. So this slide outlines our duties and responsibilities. And of course, the prosecution of criminal cases represents the core function of all district attorney's offices. However, we are increasingly involved in additional work. All offices handle delinquency cases, and just about every office works with DHS on dependency matters. And while we're not going to spend your limited time today discussing the details of this important work, if it is assigned to you, we would encourage this committee to conduct a hearing on House Bill 2345, which implements the governor's legal representation and dependency task force, as we believe the DA's office's continued involvement in child dependency cases is instrumental to child safety. Over half of the DA's offices handle child support enforcement in cases that do not involve public assistance. Every office has a crime victims assistance program as well. And beyond these primary functions, elected DAs, much like all of you, are busier than ever with a wide range of community obligations. The district attorneys and their deputies have three key performance measures, and largely these reflect services for which there's some level of state support. The first key performance measure is the percentage of child support collected relative to the total child support owed. The key performance measure target is 80%. In 2015, the DA's office has collected at about 77.7%. Not reflected in the chart, but in the materials that you have, is the 2016 performance, which is up to 78.2%. Additionally, it's worth noting that while DA's offices handle under 40% of the overall caseload, they are responsible for approximately 60% of the collection statewide. The second performance measure is the percentage of cases where the victim was provided notice of victim's rights within 5 days of the defendant's arraignment. Our target key performance measure is 90%, and we have far exceeded that in each of the last 5 years. In fact, in 2016 was our best year to date, with 97% of victims receiving timely notice of their rights. And finally, our last performance measure is the percentage of DA's offices resolving cases through early resolution and specialty courts. Our target is 92%, and in 2016, 89% of our cases were so resolved. This is a small drop-off from 2015, but it still remains much higher than in decades previous. Frankly, there are some cases that simply need to be resolved through litigation. But perhaps more important than the number of cases resolved pretrial are the number of specialty courts available to assist individuals with a wide range of services. Each year, that number increases, and as of this past year, there are over 70 such programs available throughout Oregon. These courts are a critical tool to both avoiding prison and, more importantly, to getting people back on their feet and out of the criminal justice system. As you already know, these programs receive both county funds and state funds through the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission via their specialty court program and through JRI. The current CJC budget contemplates a reduction of over 20% for specialty courts and cuts to JRI funding. Unfortunately, this will make it nearly impossible for many communities to continue to operate their programs at current levels. If those funds are cut, expect to see a smaller number of cases resolved through treatment courts, and unfortunately, more offenders unable to abide by the terms of their probation. And whenever you have an offender who can't abide by the terms of his or her probation, that inevitably means more offenders will end up in prison. Well, those were the written performance measures. The bulk of our work is related to the intake, evaluation, and resolution of criminal cases. And we want to take a few minutes to highlight some of the facts and figures surrounding that, related to the prosecution function. And for that, I'm going to turn those over to Kevin.
Thanks, Rick. I did, as Rick said, I thought it might be interesting and illuminating for you all to take a look at what actually happens day to day in the offices of the district attorneys. A lot of people, I think there's a real perception that that the district attorneys largely just send people to prison all day long. And that's not actually what we do most of the time. And I think this slide, I asked Rod Underhill up in Multnomah County, just give me a snapshot of what happens in a year. And what he said is we get almost 25,000 cases presented to us by law enforcement. Of those 25,000 cases, only 17,000 actually are opened and charges are filed. Of those, as you can see, the vast majority end up as misdemeanors. So those folks get misdemeanor treatment, typically through a plea agreement of some sort. Only 5,200 of those cases ultimately end up in a felony charge. And of those original 24,257 cases, only 792 actually end up in prison. So if you look at the left side of the screen up there, you'll see from our 100% starting point, only in Multnomah County, 3.3% of those original folks that were brought to our attention through law enforcement actually end up in our state Department of Corrections. That's not to say that there aren't folks that end up in jail at some point in that process. But I think it's really important to point out that close to 97% of the people that the district attorneys work with on a day-to-day basis, we know, are right back out in our communities. And so that's why these programs that engage folks in treatment and try to keep them from reoffending are so vital to the day-to-day operations of our offices. Again, 97% of these folks end up right back out in our communities. I have Multnomah County up here, but I wanted to just show you a snapshot of the state. I thought it might be useful to see what's happening around the state. So I asked Clackamas County for their numbers, and I think you'll see a pattern here. Again, 100% of the cases come in. About 20 to 25% of those cases never have charges filed. In Clackamas County, only 3.5% of those offenders ever end up in prison. In Marion County, they've seen, as many of you know, tremendous change in the population there. They're under 3% of those offenders going to prison right now. Jackson County, 3%. Washington County, from 100 to 4.7%. So I have one final slide that looks at all of those counties in aggregate. And as you can see, we were surprised when we collected this data. It ended up being very similar county to county to county.
Sure.
100%.
Yes, Representative Sanchez, yeah. Can we like a question?
Yes, please. Thank you, Madam Chair. So if pretty far away from here. 26.4% of those folks actually were charged with a felony. Where'd that go? Because that does not make a lot of sense to me. Are we still holding on? I mean, are some of those cases still pending? Or felonies just don't go away generally, do they?
Co-chair Winters, Co-chair Stark, representatives, and senators, they don't go away. And in fact, we have a slide that walks through the disposition of those cases. But again, they certainly are charged with a felony. Some of them end up in prison, but the vast majority of folks that are charged with felonies don't end up in prison. They end up on probation typically. And so again, I have a slide that addresses that in just 1 second. Again, I mentioned this when I testified in front of you all on Thursday about the corrections budget. Really, one of the important performance measures, I think, for most district attorneys.
Excuse me.
I'm sorry, Mr. Neely. I just wanted to clarify one other thing about those last slides you were showing, Mr. Neely. If you just look at the Multnomah County one, just because it's where I'm getting my baseline. When you say 24,257 cases, are those that many individuals or that many crimes, or how does that break down in terms of the number of people that we're talking about?
Sure. Co-Chair Stark, Co-Chair Winters, Senator Steiner-Hayward, I think 24,254 cases, that's the number of cases that are brought to the DA's office from the law enforcement community. So in Multnomah County, it could be the sheriff's office.
I didn't ask my question correctly.
Okay, I'm sorry. Or maybe I didn't hear it right.
Yeah, please.
Co-Chair Winters, Co-Chair Start, Senator Steiner-Hayward, when you say individual cases that are coming from law enforcement, that means a discrete crime episode, if you will, or a discrete case as it relates to one individual. Now, you can imagine you could have an individual that law enforcement submits multiple cases regarding over a course of time, but each case represents crime as it relates to an individual.
Well, thank you. I just want to make sure. I think so, but I'm going to ask a clarifying question. I'm going to give you two examples, and you tell me if I get this correctly. Somebody decides that robbing a convenience store is a good idea. And they go in there and they threaten the clerk and they bust up some stuff and they steal things, and that's going to be a single case with multiple charges brought against that person, right? But if they don't get caught that first time and they go on and they do it multiple different times, then it could be that when law enforcement catches up with them, they get charged with multiple cases for the different episodes. Or is it only if it's they're caught and charged, and then they go on and do something else that's different while they're out in the community? Am I asking the right question?
Absolutely. And Co-Chair Winters, Co-Chair Stark, Senator, so if I may answer your hypothetical with a hypothetical.
Please.
So if, for example, that person robbed Circle K.
Right.
And then a couple nights later they robbed 7-Eleven.
Right.
And then a couple nights later they robbed
Plaid Pantry. Yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
So when those cases came in, the district attorney's office would probably consolidate them all into a single indictment.
Okay.
So I assume for purposes of counting the case, that would be three law enforcement referrals.
So that would be three of that 24,257. That would take it down to, but it might end up in one indictment with multiple counts, which is not what you're measuring here.
Correct. Or if you had a better example would be, you had a person who was accused of felony DUI on one night, and then 3 weeks later was accused of robbing Circle K.
Right.
Those would absolutely be two separate cases.
Two separate cases. Right. Thank you very much. I appreciate the clarification.
Or since it's Multnomah County, some recent events, and you had the demonstrations that occurred in Multnomah County, and you could get 11 cases in one night.
For 11 different individuals.
11 individuals in one night.
Right.
And I would only add that counties count this stuff differently. So Multnomah County, for example, does count the way their IT system works. It's an IT system of folks. At the end of the day, it all comes down to your IT system. The way their IT system works is it actually tracks individuals. So that 17,481 cases open, that is individual cases open for individual people. Marion County, for example, they don't track by the person. They track by the charge. So they keep track
of how many charges they file. So, Kevin, given that, and given that you have an association and given associations talk about, you know, how we can make things better or more clear and what have you, isn't some discussion show that there is some kind of consistency and what have you across the 36 counties?
Go ahead.
No, I mean, you got 36 of you all meeting together, and it just seems to me if you've got one county per case and others are, that's not the way it's done. At some point, particularly since anymore, everybody tends to be data-driven.
Co-Chair Winters, Co-Chair Stark, members of the committee, one of the challenges that we have amongst the 36 DAs is that we don't have a shared data system. We don't have a shared IT system, and so that efficiency alone that you're suggesting could make a tremendous difference. What we find in Douglas County, Josephine County, counties that have lots of room on the I-5 corridor, is that we'll get a defendant that starts in one of our counties and travels and is committing crime up and down the freeway. And so when there's a while at some level we may be aware that from a police report that this was a spree, how the case is processed in Douglas County is completely independent to how it's processed in Josephine County, and it's completely independent to how it's processed in Lane County. It would be absolutely more efficient, as you correctly point out, if there was shared IT and a shared information as it relates to particular cases. Did that answer your question?
In part, but I think what I'm trying to get at is, you know, just as we're looking, as we begin as a society of looking at more transparency and what's occurring in all of our various systems, those, you know, it's beginning to say that, you know, language and all that's the same and how we count things are the same, so that, you know, whether it happens in Douglas County or it happens in Deschutes County or it happens in Marion County, to take some of the confusion out of the work that we all do, so that, you know, John Q. Public, whether they're in Jackson or Josephine or Deschutes or Marion, understands our language and why we do certain things. And that's what I'm trying to say. At some point in the future, as you guys look together as your own association, this may be something that you might want to, you know, kind of talk about.
Absolutely.
Continue.
Thank you.
I'm going to fast forward here for a second. So again, as I was saying, I think one of the main measuring sticks that the district attorneys often use is what's happening with crime. And we have been very fortunate in Oregon, as many of you know, and we've had a sustained period of time in which crime has consistently dropped for quite some time. And so that's a great thing for the state. We have far fewer victims out there across the board. So from that perspective, a lot of the work we're doing feels like it's paying off. Yeah.
Yes, Representative Huffman.
Thank you. Either one of you, is there any uniformity within the association as far as how you approach justice reinvestment and supporting that within your counties, community corrections, and cleaning things out, and or however that might work out? Is there any uniformity throughout the state, or are all the DAs pretty much on board with justice reinvestment? A lot of questions there, sorry.
What? So as it relates to uniformity, the uniformity comes from the sort of the instructions from the Criminal Justice Commission, from the legislature, understanding that those monies are to be targeted at treatment, and that they're targeted specifically to help make sure that folks don't reoffend, and that more fundamentally that they are able to get their lives together and leave the system entirely. Now, how that looks in each individual community is a little bit different. I'm aware of some of the tremendous efforts that are happening in Marion County, more of some of the tremendous efforts that are happening in Multnomah County. In Douglas County, what we have done is we've taken that money and invested it in something that we called our RSAT program. And what the RSAT program is a intensive drug treatment program. It's essentially until recently, the only inpatient drug treatment you could get in the county. And it's run through the jail for a period of time. And then those folks that successfully graduate that come out and then go into drug court. And then when they successfully graduate that, then they come back into our community. And so the uniformity is sort of the overarching purpose. But to the Criminal Justice Commission's credit and the legislature's credit, have given each community the ability to tailor it what makes the most sense for each individual community.
Follow up. So the answer is yes. There is some uniformity or commonality. However, one crime could be committed in Wasco County and the same crime committed in Marion County, but it could be handled differently depending on treatment programs or how the county is approaching justice reinvestment.
Respectfully, not so much from the standpoint of the laws are written in such a way that that depending on the crime, there are certain crimes with mandatory sentences and or presumptive sentences, and if you're prosecuting for a crime in Wasco and you're prosecuting for a crime in Marion, from a theoretical standpoint, those two defendants should be treated the same. If they're both convicted, I mean, of course, they're innocent until proven guilty, but if they're both convicted, then they're both subject to either the sentencing guidelines and or any other mandatory minimums. Where it gets somewhat, there becomes some level of differentiation is the programs that are available as they are incarcerated and the programs that are available to them as they leave their incarceration. So, for example, there are programs in Marion County that are designed to pick up folks when they're coming out of prison and to help them integrate back into society. Those are specialty programs that don't exist in most of the rest of the counties.
Okay, thank you.
Just a point of clarity, because we actually are listened to by sometimes the public, and just to put a little more context around that, there is also the difference in everything is not the same, because the crime and then plus more crime, or how the plea bargaining and all this goes into play. I don't want to leave those who are listening to us that we have uniformity and all this. So I just needed that clarification.
Absolutely. And Madam Co-Chair, Co-Chair Stark, it's absolutely true that each case is unique. Each fact pattern is unique. Each individual that's accused is unique, has their own unique record, and all of those things go into and there are within the boundaries. I mean, there is prosecutorial discretion, and so there is, you could have a prosecutor, in one county that looks at a case somewhat different than a prosecutor in another county. Is that fairly said, Senator?
Yep.
Before you go.
Yeah.
You don't mind. I'll go back to
that
last
one. Senator Fred.
Thank you very much. How does that compare nationally? Did we see a violent crime rate drop nationally as well? And was it at the same rate?
Co-chairs, members of the committee, we did see a tremendous drop, over 51% drop in our violent crime rate. I'm only talking about violent crime.
Right.
It's different as it relates to property crime. But yes, there was a we had literally kind of gone from the top of the heap in terms of likelihood of being violently victimized down towards definitely the bottom quartile. I can get you the exact numbers, but yes, we had a disproportionate shift in the likelihood of victimization here in Oregon over the course of the last 25 years.
Compared to other states, is that what you're saying?
Yes, compared to other states.
Okay, that's good to know. Thank you.
Just to go back a little bit, because I know that some studies are taking place and the disproportionality that exists among the minority population, and all the results aren't out yet, but I think that they're beginning to show that there is, in fact, a disproportionate when you look at some of the sentencing and what's going on in our public safety environment.
Absolutely. I think you're absolutely right about that. There is, and it's something that most of the district attorneys are keenly aware of. And I would, I know, as you all know, certainly many district attorneys, in some cases like Multnomah County, they're actively looking at ways that they can try to ensure that we are handling our business very even-handedly. And I think that there, I can assure you, we have had many, many meetings of the Oregon District Attorneys Association that have been where we've had significant discussions about why that's happening, if it is some responsibility of the district attorney. So it's something we're keenly aware of and certainly appreciate the important attention that's being put to it.
And that's correct. I can speak for the 36 electeds. We're keenly aware of that and very concerned about it.
I have been concerned about it for some time, because this is not the first time I've raised this particular issue, and I know that there's somebody who will be talking later that he and I have had this conversation when he was on the parole board. And if you look at the statistics over time, Oregon does not have anything to say in very proud numbers about that we have addressed this issue. And if you look at the length of stay inside of our institution, here again, when I've asked for the agencies to provide me with the statistics, they don't look good to us. Doesn't look as bad as Louisiana, but they still don't look good. So I just have to, put that out there. We can continue to say we're looking at it, and I can remember when the good representative, who now is president of NAACP, when she was here in 99, she raised those issues in 1999. So it's something that we are going to begin, as these reports come out, to be a lot more vigilant and be a lot more corrective as we look at how we do our sentencing.
Rep. Sanchez, getting back to what you were asking about earlier, here's my slide on that topic. And again, I think what's important to note is the vast majority of folks, when I said earlier, 97% of the folks end up back out in our communities. Even those folks that do receive felonies, again, the vast majority of folks here in Oregon that are convicted of a felony end up right back in the community. And so we need to make sure that we have the resources in place to help them and to make sure that there aren't new victims. So, again, as you can see here, 24% of felonies is all that ever end up actually heading to prison. So, and I think this is also a really important slide. As we talk about the change in crime rates, I think we always need to ask ourselves, are we focusing on the right people? And in Oregon, again, and I would just tell you that we have largely focused on violent offenders. And so, and this data is from 2010. We just don't have more current data than that. So I can't tell you if this has changed in the last 7 years, but we don't think so. Number one, in terms of the rate of offenders that are going to prison that are violent offenders. Second, from the bottom, in terms of rate of offenders that are going on drug crimes. Now, note, there's not 50 states here. This is a survey that was done I don't have it listed up there, but it was done, I'm pretty sure, by the FBI in the course of their UCR collecting. I'll double check on that. But again, We're using our resources, or we're making every effort to use those resources as effectively as possible and focusing on the violent offenders in our community, not those folks that have been convicted of drug crime. So I'm going to turn it back over to Rick to kind of finish things up here.
Thank you, Kevin, for that overview. So I hope that that offered some perspective on the work that we do. And while we are only 12.5 million of the public safety system budget, well under 1%, we absolutely recognize the impact that we have on overall public safety system. Obviously, our job in obviously your job in this committee is to consider the financial impact. But as you well know, with your work and ours, they have an important and measurable safety impact on all of our communities. We absolutely believe that our efforts to make our counties better places to live and work, and we are deeply committed to achieving the greatest possible safety at the best possible price. We wanted to wrap up today with a few of the challenges that we face. First, we want to be sure that as we move forward, salaries continue to be competitive so that we can attract and retain the best possible district attorneys. Second, our budget is so small that we must regularly come back before the e-board or the legislature to seek additional appropriations, even for small changes in our service charges. It seems like a small thing, but it makes a difference to our members as they are confronted with a budget that will not pay their salaries throughout the biennium. And finally, and this is highlighted in bold, we believe that the DAs and their deputies is the only agency with absolutely no central budget or services. And we are very grateful for the work of DOJ. It simply does not make sense for 36 independently elected officials to run their own budget, performance measures, and pay through the offices of both the Attorney General and the Governor. And so while we generally share the same objectives and agenda, that's not always the case. And for that reason, it's critical that we have some level of state support for basic operations.
Question. Given the 50 states, are the majority of the DAs, number one, elected? And number two, is the majority in the same kind of a funding mechanism that we do in Oregon? Or what are there some other variations?
Co-chairs, members of the committee, I think I'll tackle the first part of that question. I may need some clarification on the second piece. I would say that most of the district attorneys start their careers by being appointed often by the governor.
Okay.
Often DAs will leave midterm, and so it's not uncommon for the governor to make an appointment. Though we have done a fair amount of review about what happens after that, and virtually every district attorney, in fact, we had a lovely conversation at lunch today about it, virtually every district attorney at some point has to run a contested campaign. Often it's that very first campaign right out of the gate.
But the office basically is an elected office.
Yes, it is. They're all elected offices. They serve a four-year term, just like the senators do. And we usually have 18 up each cycle. If you are appointed, just like with a Senate seat, you have to run in the next election, and then you get back on your cycle thereafter.
So how are the majority across the country funded?
I think the answer to that, I will tell you that the district attorney function across the country varies. Most states have a operating district attorney system like we have here, where they represent a county or a district, and they are independently elected state officials. And many, many states also do have funding at the county level, like we have here in Oregon. However, there are states, I'll give you an example, Alaska, and Alaska is not the only one. Every single district attorney is appointed by the Attorney General, and they operate under the auspices of the Department of Justice. What is, I believe, unique about Oregon, however, is that we have 36 elected officials that are literally a state agency. And it used to be that there was a whole bunch of other funding that went in there, witness fees, all sorts of things. It was abandoned long ago, and now all that's in there is just the salaries for the DAs. What is unique, and I think this is what Mr. Wiesenberg was kind of chatting about, is we don't have any administration for that work. We rely on Art, who's sitting behind us at the Department of Justice, to pay our salaries for us, to prepare our budget documents for us, or they have to hire someone out of pocket to do that work. So that's what's so unique about the situation we're in right now.
Thank you.
And so to pick up where Kevin was saying, for years we've asked for modest funding for either our own agency staff or a direct appropriation to the Oregon District Attorneys Association so that we have internal resources to fulfill basic administrative obligations of a state agency. That policy option package was not included in the governor's recommended budget. So nevertheless, a small administrative budget would obviously go a very long way for us. So if we had enhanced centralized services, this is what it would look like. And this is very similar to what Co-Chair Winters was referencing earlier. If we had centralized services, it would mean greater continuity of the prosecution function throughout the state. It would mean better training and education. Every year, literally hundreds of court cases change the face of our work in nuanced ways. Ensuring that every deputy DA in every county is abreast of those changes is a Herculean task. It would mean that we could stop relying on DOJ for budget development and administration. It would mean that we could invest in finding new resources to help offset existing costs and improve service delivery with new funding and specialized grants focused on specialized challenges or specific challenges. It would mean better coordination with other public safety partners and the legislature. And finally, it may mean that we could centralize some of our core functions that would streamline our justice system. For example, as we spoke earlier, there's no centralized IT system across DA's offices. And as a result, you could have an individual charged in several different counties with different crimes over the course of a spree. And instead of consolidating those cases in one county, there may be three separate prosecutions, which means three separate defense attorneys, three separate plea negotiations or trials, and in the end, three separate sentences that may or may not be served concurrently. At a minimum, a centralized case management system would likely eliminate multi-county offender holds, and the best-case scenario would mean fewer attorneys, fewer convictions, and fewer sentences. In our view, the $500,000 investment would more than pay for itself, and of course we'll continue to work with the governor and the legislature to see about someday moving this agency out from under the shadow of DOJ into a place where we're able to really invest in statewide improvements that are critical to the effective application of justice. Of course, that was sort of fantasy, as Co-Chair Winters, Co-Chair Stark is. Co-Chair, I just tickled a funny bone. So the reality is that here are our mandated reduction options. And while they are represented in work days, the fact of the matter is any reduction will result in cuts in DA salaries. Being a district attorney is a 365-day-a-year job. We unfortunately regularly work nights, weekends, holidays, and we get called on our vacations. There really isn't such a thing as taking 28 days off or 56 days off or 84 days off. I know that I represent all 35 of my colleagues in imploring you to maintain our very reasonable compensation. And with that final plea, that concludes our presentation, and we'd
any
be happy
question?
To field.
I just had a side conversation. Excuse me, Senator Frederick.
I am curious about the coordination that takes place between the DAs and the e-court system. Are you connected? You're obviously connected with that. How does e-court fit into your concerns about coordination? Is that part of that? Is it a piece of that puzzle or what?
Sure. So e-court is I will confess, Chairman Winters, Chairman Stark, members of the committee, I'm a dinosaur when it comes to technology. But I have watched with fascination as with the advent of eCourt and the advent of other data systems, eCourt has been a fascinating development, and I believe there will be tremendous data sets for the legislature and for us all to mine in the future and to get some clarity on various pictures as to what's happening in the judiciary. E-court doesn't capture, however, what the law enforcement does, and it doesn't capture what comes into the district attorney's offices, and it only captures cases that are filed, and so there's a whole number of cases that e-court won't capture, but there is tremendous efficacy in e-court, and there's tremendous potential to get a better, clearer pictures as we go down the road. I don't know if I answered your question.
Somewhat you did, but it seems to me that you just mentioned that e-court does capture the cases that are filed. So that's a significant portion of what you're dealing with. So it would seem that that would help in terms of the coordination that you might need and just getting information about what might be needed and what changes might be taking place. County to county, as you mentioned before, if a cases have been filed and it's the same person, you would certainly be able to pick that out and figure that out by way of the e-court system, wouldn't you?
Yes, in theory, that would be distinguishable from sort of a direct link that where all 36 DAs are able to communicate with each other when the case comes in, if you will. But could we, if we had a defendant, could we look at e-court and see if that defendant currently has cases elsewhere in the state? You're absolutely right.
I would only add, co-chairs, I think that is happening. I think increasingly, as now all counties are on board with e-court, increasingly you see deputy district attorneys checking to see what's going on, if there is other cases out there. I would tell you that in states that have centralized IT services, typically if you type in an offender name in most of those states, what happens is it alerts you.
Yes.
When there are other cases out there. That's not the case with e-court. So it needs to be a proactive decision that's made by a deputy district attorney who often has a pretty big caseload. But I do think as more and more technologically savvy DDAs are out there, that will certainly increase our ability to coordinate in cases in which we're able to identify common defendants.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions? Yes, Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I suppose it could be a variety of reasons why it happens, but occasionally DOJ sends somebody in to prosecute a case. Who pays DOJ for that prosecutor to come into a county? Does the county have to bear that expense, or how does that work?
Co-Chair Winters, Co-Chair Stark, members of the committee, Representative Huffman. There's actually a statutory provision that would allow DOJ to bill the counties for prosecution services. It has been the practice of the Criminal Justice Division, and it's been the Attorney General's practice not to bill counties for prosecution services. DOJ or the Attorney General and DOJ will bill for non-prosecution related services, i.e., as state officers, we call DOJ if we need legal advice, we get a bill for that. But if DOJ comes down to prosecute a crime, I've never received a bill, and I have to tell you that the Attorney General and the Criminal Justice Division. Currently under Mr. Slauson, they do a tremendous job, and they are available 24/7 to us if we need. Obviously, we try not to overutilize that resource either. I hope I've answered your question.
I would only add, interestingly, right now the Klamath County District Attorney is from the Department of Justice because. Mr. Patridge left, and in those instances where we have a vacancy, often DOJ, through their District Attorney Assistance Program, steps in and fills those vacancies. So it's a really vital role.
Thank you.
And there's two ways that they, pardon me.
Short answer, state general funds that funds it.
Yeah, it is the state general fund.
Yes. And Co-Chair Winters, Co-Chair Stark, members of the committee, so there's two ways that DOJ will come in. There are cases that they initiate themselves.
When they do, they come to us and ask us.
The most common you'll hear is their internet child pornography cases, where they capture and see this, and they will generally they will request permission to come in and prosecute those cases. I've never said no, and then. You know, they're depending on your county and on certain cases. If there's a conflict or an incredibly complex matter that you need their expertise, you simply have to request it, and then they come.
Just so it's built into DOJ's base budget, and if it exceeds that and they need to have they have something special that's going on out in the county that has exceeded that budget, they will come in and ask eBoard or others in order to get the dollars that they need in order to provide the service. So, thank you.
Thank you very much.
And I believe at this point, we've got. Do you have additional comments, Mr. Neely?
I don't.
But CSFO, they're going to go through the governor's budget, and then. Then I'll get to my...
I don't have anything to add to their elegant presentation.
You have to come up for the record, though. So can you wait just a minute, my good friend? Thank you.
Sorry. Let's see if I can spare us, and we'll go through it this way for whatever reason. Can't get it to full screen. Good afternoon, Co-Chair Winters and members of the committee. I'm Michelle Lisper. I'm with the Department of Administration, Chief Financial Office. My presentation is be fairly quick, given their budget. What you're seeing up here is just a expenditure history. Obviously, FTE count hasn't changed. It's 36 district attorneys, one for each county throughout the state. And this is showing you the expenditure history over time since 2009-11 actuals up through the current governor's budget is at $12.5 million general fund. Very similar slide, 94% of their expenditure by category is personal services, which pays the DA salaries, and 6% is for services and supplies, as they mentioned. Basically, the investments in the governor's budget is to support their current service level. We did not recommend any reductions to their salaries or to their services and supply expenditure limitation. And that's what all I have for
any
the governor's
questions?
Budget.
Thank you very much, Ms. Lisper. So with that, can I have up? D.A. Felton and Commissioner Cameron.
Hi, you want me to go first?
Please.
Different perspective. Wants to hear from the world lawyer anyway. Yeah, well, I'm not an attorney, so Madam Co-Chair Winters and Co-Chair Stark, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kevin Cameron, Marion County Commissioner. First of all, I want to say thank you for your service. It's great to see you on that side. I did sit in Rep. Pelosi's chair years ago. Representative Barker and I think Representative Hanna was in between us, if I remember right. I sat on this committee, but Senator, you were here too. So thank you. It's good to be here with you. And first of all, I am honored to be a constituent of Senator Winters, and if you haven't looked at Facebook lately, you can see that I kissed your ring last week out here in the lobby. I want to thank Senator Winters also for the years of leadership on public safety issues that have made a difference throughout not only Marion County but our entire state. And Senator, thank you very much for all you do. Marion County has been a leader in reentry programs. In 2007, I joined the Governor's Reentry Council, appointed by Governor Kulongowski at that time, and also Marion County. And we are privileged here in Marion County to have a great DA in Walt Biglaw, and the reason he is not here today is because he is actually working on his budget over at the county to make sure we fund all his deputy DAs out of our general fund, of which about 80% of our general fund dollars in Marion County go to
fund our public safety programs between our DA, our juvenile, and our sheriff's office. But one of the things I want to say about our DA is that he is one of those individuals, along with our sheriff, along with our juvenile department, along with our courts, that have really taken the bull by the horns, 3194, and Representative, I know you and I were one of, or two of nine Republicans who voted with Democrats to pass House Bill 3194 in 2013. And our DA is at the table all the way to help us be creative with those programs that have made a huge difference in the lives of public safety lives of Marion County, as well as the lives of people who have gotten into the programs that that money has allowed us to do. The district attorneys have stepped up, the sheriff's office stepped up, our community corrections department has stepped up, and we're now providing more programs in Marion County than ever before as a result of the work from this body and the way you have allocated those funds. Even our victim services department has two areas that we funded this last year due to 3194, and with the DA's help. We have now recently added a deputy district attorney just to focus on mental health cases in Marion County. So there's a lot of good things happening. Also in our district attorney's office right now, the LEAD program, which is Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion, that's a model out of Seattle. Paige Clarkston is working to interject that with our sheriff, so you're going to see some more good things happening as a result of the DA's office and their willingness to work with other public safety individuals. So these collaborative efforts are working in Marion County, and I know in other counties as well. And so, but what we need is stable funding to support our DA's office, and I'm going to lobby for 3194 while I'm sitting here in front of you. I might as well, because when we passed that bill, and I think it was around $50 million we were going to get in savings on that bill, and last year we got about $30 million or $32 million on that, and we would love to see those dollars still come to protect our people in the future. But funding for the district attorney is what we're here talking about today, and they are one of the key aspects to our public safety system that we need to protect. And it remains a key state-county partner relationship. The budget issues have caused state funding for district attorneys to be reduced over the last 15 to 20 years, with counties picking up the tab. We're happy to do that. We're working hard to make sure we can continue to do that. But we really want your consideration, and we heard a lot about, and I heard the discussion as I was sitting there, that the DAs, there's 36 district attorneys that are elected, but they have no really support for their budget. And I look around the table here, and there's 60 of you in the House and 30 of you in the Senate who are elected officials, and you have support to make sure that you have your budget, and those things are important to all of us as elected officials. So your investment in the district attorneys and other aspects of public safety system are appreciated by not only myself as a Marion County commissioner, but all of those commissioners from AOC and the district attorneys. So I want to thank you today for your time, and I would be happy to answer questions. I also want to thank the Douglas County District Attorney Rick Wiesenberg, who is here as the new leader of the district attorneys. So thank you very much.
Questions? Comment? You can stay there, and I'll hear from the good DA from Polk County, and then I'll have a comment.
Uh-oh.
Thank you, Co-Chair Winters, Co-Chair Stark, members of the committee. My name is Aaron Felton. I am the District Attorney of Polk County and a constituent of Co-Chair Winters, and I wholly associate myself with everything that Commissioner Cameron said in regards to Co-Chair Winters. Let me backtrack a bit. I've been I'm entering my second term as district attorney in Polk County. I was a deputy DA back in the last century, and somewhere in between that time, I took a bit of a walkabout and served as parole board chair. And during that time, I got to know Senator Winters even better. In several meetings, she did ask tough questions about important policy questions, meaningful questions, and so we had some good conversations. And I appreciated those tough questions, and I've appreciated her questions today. She has steadfastly been a supporter of the public safety arena and people who are working in it and those who are going through it at the same time. So I've appreciated your work there and look forward to your questions today. I appreciate this this committee, you, those of you who are here today, those your predecessors who have supported district attorneys in our budget requests. One of the things about having a budget being coming from the state legislature, it gives elected district attorneys a measure of independence in our office. I come from a small county, as we referred to. We have 76,000 people in Polk County. We are classified as a small county. Although I'll tell you, when you drive it, when you walk door to door, and I had three contested elections, primaries and generals, and the last one, just this last time, they decided I would not have a contested election. So either I've ruined the job and nobody wants it, or they think I'm doing well enough right now. But three contested elections, so like as I think you all know, when you go door to door, it's a big county. So as I'm sure all your districts are big districts. Mm-hmm. So, nonetheless, it does give us a measure of independence as elected officials when we work in our offices with our county commissioners and other folks, so that we can kind of go eye to eye and say we have a measure of independence and the policies and issues that we advocate in our own offices. It gives us some footing in those conversations. So I value that. But on a personal level, from Polk County, I value the fact that were it not for the fact that one of the things we had to do, because we're a timber county too, we had to go to our citizens a couple times, because the first time they said no. No, thank you. We had to pass a public safety levy to pay for public safety services. It was getting pretty dire, as it is, and Rick knows exactly about this. It's getting pretty dire in terms of our public safety needs, in terms of our sheriff's office, our probation, and my own office, in terms of what we were going to be able to do. Citizens of Polk County decided they would be generous with their tax dollars and pass that levy. So fortunately, we were able to add some additional prosecutors, some additional sheriff's deputies, and we're able to make some different decisions now with those resources, with the generosity from the citizens in doing so. If we hadn't, we'd be in a different place. So having that additional funding from and stable funding from the legislature makes a huge difference. So not only is it a matter of independence, for Polk County it's a matter of survival to have that additional funding. So I appreciate that greatly. Just so for some numbers, in Polk County, I have a total staff of 18. I have 7 attorneys in addition to myself, a total of 8 prosecutors. I keep a small caseload of my own in addition to doing the administrative duties. As to the cuts, Rick was exactly right. We really don't take a day off. In fact, it's a kind of a joke around my office. Every time I do leave the county or the state, that's when the most spectacularly heinous crimes do occur in Polk County, so I'm asked never to leave. I think it's just karma or something like that. But we don't take a day off. We keep the pager. I'm always the backup. Right now, if the person who has the pager is unavailable or on a call, I'm the backup person, as I think most district attorneys are. So there are no, days off for district attorneys. I think some of the things that you talked about in terms of communication are happening in terms of data. Right now, each county has its own case management system, which does potentially link with eCourt. We're getting closer on these things. It's getting better. We are getting more efficient with those things. But each county is its own entity in terms of what it can afford, in terms of which case management system it has and how that works, because that's paid for by each individual county. My county was generous in paying for ours, and the IT department is generous in what it can do. But that's what it comes back to. If we were looking at someday having perhaps a centralized agency function, that is an ideal thing that agency function could work on in terms of planning some type, perhaps centralized function. So those are the types of efficiencies that could be created within a centralized agency for the DAs. I think that's a very practical thing that could happen in the future. With that, I just wanted to say, again, thank you very much for your support. The individualized funding does allow us, each in the way we get there, achieving our centralized functions and goals of offender accountability, seeking justice for victims, and our crime prevention programs. So again, Madam Co-Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Questions? Well, thank the two of you for your kind words. And I tried to warn you, D.A. Belton, when you came and said you were going to run. So.
Well, I think what you warned me about is everything I've gotten. So your warning was well placed, and I couldn't be happier. This is an outstanding challenge and a wonderful job. And the fact that I'm compensated for it is a bonus. So thank you.
That too. And then to my son.
Yes, Mom.
You know, and they've heard me here before of all the work that's been done in Marion County, and it's a tribute to not only the public safety community but to the county commissioners as well. And so I want to thank you and Commissioner Carlson and Brentano, because I know that in this particular county that I've been blessed to have both Marion and Polk counties in my district. And I just personally want to thank you both and thank you for all your hard work.
Thank you, Senator. And I want to thank Rep. Barker as the chair of Judiciary to help us pass a lot of those bills while I was here that have made a big difference. So thank you all for your service. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Thank you.
So anyone else who didn't get a chance to testify who would like to come up and join in since we're having our kumbaya? If not, with that, we are adjourned.
Hey.
Hi.
Hey.
Hi.